Hi there, welcome everyone to the latest edition of The Front Page, a Racing Post news analysis programme. My name is Lee Mottershead, and my goodness me, there are a lot of things for myself and my esteemed Racing Post colleagues David Jennings and Peter Skigel to talk to you about this week. We have got an excellent weekend of racing at Leopardstown and the Curra to look back on. We've got events in Parliament on Tuesday, when the UK government's gambling white paper met the scrutiny of the DCMS Select Committee. But first, a new story that broke early this morning when Kevin Stott announced on the Racing Post website that he had been sacked by Keir Jarabchin as the retained rider for Ammo Racing. Kevin, who was hired in March, has had a successful year in the job. He finished second in the Derby on King of Steel. He gave Ammo their first Group 1 victory with Bucanero Forte in the Phoenix Stakes at the Curra, and he's had group wins in the Craven Stakes, Oak Tree Stakes and Duchess of Cambridge Stakes. But Saturday wasn't a great day for Ammo Racing, and that King of Steel finished only fourth in the Irish Champion Stakes, albeit that was a big run for him on Racing Post ratings. It did not go down well at Leopardstown, it seems, with the owner Keir Jarabchin, who on Monday morning sent Kevin Stott a text message in which it was announced to Kevin that he would no longer be the retained rider for Ammo Racing. His contract was due to expire at the end of December. So that then is our opening story today. Peter Skigel has written lots about Ammo Racing in the past, and David Jennings was at Leopardstown on Saturday. So we'll start with you, DJ. First of all, it seems that this ride on King of Steel is the central point in the decision to replace Kevin Stott, albeit Keir Jarabchin has said today there were other reasons behind the decision, and he's not pointing to the King of Steel ride. But there was a sense, David, that anyone who was or people at Leopardstown on Saturday who were watching the scenes between the Ammo camp and Kevin Stott after race would have detected that there wasn't necessarily much delight in their view of how Kevin had ridden the horse. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. You've been to Leopardstown before. Where the winner comes back into the parade ring is down the very far end, or the near end if you're coming in at the entrance. And the fourth position is a good distance away. So unfortunately, I didn't witness any of this. And it's a good probably 50, 60 yards away almost, I'd say, from where the fourth would come back in. But it's very close to the actual grandstand and the back of the grandstand. I'd say a lot of people who were surrounding the parade ring, you know, you do get quite up close and personal. It's not really like, you know, sometimes in Cheltenham, they're a little bit away, or I'm trying to think of other examples, maybe Ascot, where there's a kind of a tiered terrace around the parade ring. So in Leopardstown, you do get quite up close and personal, and you're only a couple of yards away if you were along the rail there. And it seems a few people witnessed an outburst, shall we say. Again, I'm only getting secondhand information, but it does seem that the Kia wasn't overly enamoured by the ride Kevin Stott gave King of Steel. And it's funny, when I heard this, I said, well, the first thing I'm going to do is watch the race back. And there were some dubious rides in the race, I have to say. What Jim Crowley was doing on Alfleila, I'll never know. Holly, I'm sure, would love to have another go on Nashua. But if you actually watch the Champion Stakes again, and if this is the main reason why he has been sacked, yes, he might have been a little bit closer. But turning into the home straight at Leopardstown, 2.5 furlongs out, or just over 2 furlongs out, I make it from watching the video that at the very most, King of Steel is about a length and a half, a length and three quarters behind Augusto then. So it wasn't though he had 5, 6, 7 lengths to make up on Augusto then. He was ready to strike if he was good enough. And it's funny, I watched a race with a colleague of mine during the race, and I said, you know what, the whole way during the race, he settled early, which is something he didn't do in the King George. I would have been reasonably happy if I was a King of Steel backer for most of the race. And I thought he was close enough, if good enough. He didn't find trouble in running. If I was ranking the rides in the race, he wouldn't be in the bottom three rides in the race, that's for certain. It was brilliant tactics by Ballydoyle, but yeah, if that's the reason he got sacked, I think it's extremely, extremely harsh. To me, he's one of the best riders in Britain, and I think he will regret this sacking.
Pete, you have been, as I said before, a regular Ammo watcher. Did this take you by surprise or not?
It was one of those instances where you wanted to be shocked, but you weren't in the slightest. Not because of anything that happened necessarily, not because Kevin Stott did anything wrong, but I mean, this is how Kia Drabchin and Ammo work, isn't it? He's not the first jockey to be sacked or to have his relationship ended in unclear circumstances. Kia changes his trainers all of the time, or quite frequently. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a chaotic, organised chaos, if you see what I mean. It's not chaotic as in it's not arranged.
I mean, I think if you were speaking in Kia Drabchin's favour for a second, you might say that the Ross Orion situation last year was strange. In the sense that Ross Orion announced during the Ebel Festival that he wasn't going to be riding for Ammo any longer. Kia Drabchin said then that he refuted that and played down the idea that the two are parting company. And then after an internal review, the two did separate, but Ross Orion still clearly is a part of the Ammo family in that he rode the Norfolk Stakes winner for Ammo this year, Valiant Force, when Kevin Stott was on the stable's first string. So in that sense, Drabchin might say, I haven't got a problem with jockeys. But as you say, Pete, he has moved horses around yards quite a bit. And I would have just thought that whatever the reasons are behind the decision to dispense with the services of Kevin Stott, who had a contract that ran until the end of December, to send someone a text message that drops onto your phone just after 6 a.m, in which, in effect, you are given the sack. It seems a pretty crummy way to part company with a senior employee. Am I, David, being overly soft about that?
No, definitely not. Let's just say there weren't too many occasions where I've had to do this, because I was never in that sort of position. But I was always told by my mother that if you are breaking up a relationship, the worst thing you can possibly do is send somebody a text. Have the balls to give them a ring and tell them, or not even a ring, meet them face to face. Like, the most famous high profile relationship breakup in racing in the last couple of decades was obviously Davy Russell and Michael O'Leary. At least he had the decency, for all the names Michael O'Leary is called, at least he has the decency to bring him for the famous cup of tea and sack him face to face. At least he had the balls to do that. Like, to send somebody a text message, given, like, you know, he's a Group 1 winning rider who was second in the Derby, who was a good jockey, and look, I don't know Kevin Stott from Adam, but to me, he seems like a thoroughly likable guy who has always acquitted himself really well, both in, you know, I love his interviews because he's so honest and so passionate and really cares. And look, I have no idea. The stuff that Kia is saying this morning is that there's other circumstances that are behind this decision, and maybe they are. So I'm clueless as regards to them, but still, a text message, I don't know. I just think it's a bit cheap.
Indeed, just while I'm speaking about this, so the King of Steel ride has been the one that has been given most exposure here because of those scenes after the race at Leopardstown. But there was a Group 1 at the Curragh yesterday in which Ammo had two of the four runners, headed by Bucanero Forte, in the National Stakes. Now, on this occasion, I think, again, the ride maybe received more public commentary, although the way the two Ammo horses were ridden received more public commentary. But on this occasion, it does seem as though Kevin Stott was very much riding to team instructions on Buccanero Forte, whose stable companion set a very strong pace, which surprised many people. What was your take on that, on the way the Amo horses were deployed in that contest?
Well, the first thing to say is it wouldn't have mattered what way Buccanero Forte was ridden, because I'd say he probably bumped into the best two-year-old around at the moment in Henry Longfellow. But it was unbelievable to think what was done here, because if Aidan O'Brien himself had a put a Ballydoyle underdog in the race, he couldn't have planned it or executed it more brilliantly than Amo did for him. So it was astonishing to watch. And the only thing I can think of, and the only way I can kind of defend what was done between Buccanero Forte and Cuban Thunder, is that Henry Longfellow is probably a miler, and even though he does have pace, but he's probably a miler who is, you know, would struggle over six, I'd say. And obviously Buccanero Forte won the Phoenix Stakes impressively over six. And the only thing I can think of, given the tactics that were deployed, is that they thought they would be able to take Henry Longfellow out of his comfort zone in the early part of the race and get him off it early, whereas Buccanero Forte would be able to travel into it. But I think if that was the case, they really got it wrong with regard to pace with Henry Longfellow, because he travels beautifully through his races. So that's the only thing I can think of. It was utterly bizarre. By all accounts, at the Curry yesterday morning, this relationship was gone at that stage, though. And, you know, there were rumours that we would have jockey changes even before the National Stakes. Kevin did ride Buccanero Forte. But look, the horse was beaten 12 and a half lengths. He obviously, that wasn't his true running. He barely, like, at one stage, you didn't know if he was even going to beat the pacemaker, who was only rated, whatever, 80-something. So, it wasn't his true running, but it was utterly bizarre tactics. I think everybody in the stand, I watched the race, and Sam was scratching their heads, didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, no, I was the same watching it from home. And Peter, just finally, again, Keir Drabchin sounds pretty confident that they won't have trouble getting high-profile jockeys on the horses in the future. He spoke to Nick Luck today and said he hasn't got a problem with jockeys. There is no issue between him and jockeys. But if you were a high-profile jockey and you were offered an Amo job for 2024, do you think you'd be sort of thinking, is this the sort of role I really want to go for?
Potentially. I mean, the fact is, if Keir Drabchin and Amo want to retain jockey for next year, they'll get one, because it's a prominent role, and there's an opportunity to ride nice horses, and people always take those opportunities, don't they? Keir's a guy that he likes to promote younger people, doesn't he, in terms of his trainers and associates. So wouldn't necessarily surprise you if it was a less senior jockey who took the role. I'm not sure that in terms of finding somebody, because they'll find somebody. Who it is, yeah, they might have to go through a few names before they get there, but I'm sure someone will take it if they want to. I was just going to say to you, Lee, you're the only one of us who's had any dealings with Kevin Stott today since it happened. How was he? What sort of impression did you get in terms of how he's going to come out of this situation?
I spoke with Kevin this morning. He sounded pretty not relaxed about it, but he was taking it well. I don't think he necessarily saw it as a great surprise based on what had happened over the weekend. And he was very clear in the statement that he gave that he didn't want to be disrespectful towards Keir Drabchin. He wasn't rude about him. He was very clear that he wanted to thank Amo and the Amo Racing trainers for the opportunities that he has been given this year. But I think he was, albeit maybe not surprised that this decision had been made, perplexed as to the reasons behind it, because in the message he was sent, he wasn't given a reason. There was no explanation given to Kevin Stott as to why he had lost the job. And therefore, I do think it's easy to feel sympathy for him. I interviewed him as well earlier in the year after he got the job, and I found him very likeable, very impressive. And I think he's a really smart jockey. You know, we've seen what he's done this year. He had that treble, didn't he, on one of the afternoons at the July Festival at Newmarket. And I suspect that what he has done this season will stand him in good stead.
What's
for the
feeling
future
about Kevin in England, Lee? I've always been a big fan. I've written complimentary things about him. Only two of his last 39 rides have won. He's on a really bad run. Like, he's on a 5% strike rate in the last fortnight. And obviously jockeys go through, you know, fits and starts. That can happen. Like,
yeah.
And but overall, I would say he would be regarded from my point of view as, you know, he probably would sneak into the top five maybe riders in Britain at the moment. But is that an unfair assessment? Is he maybe not as rated as highly as I would rate him?
No, I don't think that's the case, DJ. I think he's highly rated. I think, you know, as you say, the percentages at the moment aren't great, but all top jockeys, all top trainers go through highs and lows, don't they? Periods when they can't stop riding winners and periods when it's a bit harder to do. But no, I think he's an extremely talented jockey, as I think he's shown that on a number of occasions this year. And I'd be pretty confident that depending on which avenue he wants to go down, because he went freelance for a while, didn't he, after leaving Kevin Ryan, and he made a big impression in that relatively short time when he was riding as a freelance. I think he'll be grand going forwards.
Would he be spoken about highly enough to be in the running for the Gosden job when Frankie retires?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, John Gosden has been pretty clear in saying that he doesn't plan to retain a jockey in 2024. But of course, that doesn't mean there won't be a jockey or jockeys that he uses on a regular basis. Kieran Schumark has been the name that has been most in the frame for that. And Kieran's name has been spoken about for that long, long time ago, earlier in the year, when it became apparent that Frankie wouldn't be riding in 2024. So I imagine that Kieran Schumark probably is the most likely candidate. And certainly he's been getting some high profile rides throughout the summer for John and Thady Gosden, including on Isra at Kempton on Saturday. But I'm sure that a lot of people will now be thinking about Kevin Stott for big horses and for big rides in 2024 and maybe even a big job. That then was the situation regarding Kevin Stott and Ammo Racing this morning. Before we move on to part two, in a happier development, I have very positive things to tell you about the Racing Post Members Club.
Are you ready to take your passion for horse racing to the next level? With Racing Post Members Club, you gain exclusive access to the best racing insights, analysis, and tools. Immerse yourself in award-winning content, from interviews with the sport's biggest stars to race previews and behind-the-scenes features. Get the inside track with early access to the Racing Post digital newspaper from 9 p.m. in the evening and daily selections from our expert tipsters. Racing Post Members Club is your ultimate ticket to the thrilling world of racing. Subscribe today and pay just £9.99 per month for the first 2 months with the code SUMMER. See the link in the video description for more information. Terms apply.
Hi there, welcome back to the Front Page. Our second story is very different to our first. It takes us to the Palace of Westminster, where on Tuesday, the Department of Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee heard evidence from both the government and the Gambling Commission regarding the government's gambling white paper. I was there with industry editor Bill Barber reporting on it, and Pete Scargill was watching keenly from afar. Pete, over to you.
I was watching keenly, hoping for something to develop that we could move forward with, Lee, because as you know yourself, we've been waiting for more details, for things to be fleshed out, for you know, some positive movement forwards in terms of what's going on. So Andrew Rhodes, Tim Miller and Sarah Gardner from the Gambling Commission were interviewed, you know, cross-examined by the panel, and gave, you know, a range of mostly dissatisfying answers, which I'm sure we'll come on to, from talk about affordability checks and how frictionless they may be, to things like the, you know, safer gambling. You know, all in all, it wasn't, we wanted a bit more depth. Some more insight was provided by Stuart Andrew, who primarily offered some assurances to horse racing, British horse racing, that we wouldn't be too hammered by what's going on. But I don't know, after the big build-up, it didn't really live up to our expectations, did it? It was a bit of a, you know, you came away wanting more, but not we were entertained wanting more, as in, can we just have some more, please?
Yeah, in the piece I wrote after this session, I did say that sometimes you look forward to a contest and hope it's going to be a Corto Denman or a Grundy Bustina or an Arkell Millhouse. So they don't always pan out those great head-to-heads. And certainly, I think the DCMS committee, the government and gambling commission, was one of those. Certainly, the session with Andrew Rhodes, the gambling commission chief executive, I thought was very light on questioning about what even Andrew Rhodes had said had been the most contentious part of the Gambling Commission's white paper consultation, namely affordability checks. But Stuart Andrew, when he was questioned by the MPs, there was a sense in which he maybe took things forward slightly when he said that in terms of the enhanced checks, which are a feature of the white paper, that when the government talks about frictionless, they mean frictionless, and that punters who are subjected or involved with enhanced checks should find them to be a frictionless exercise. He was asked by one MP what that actually would mean in practice and how would the checks be frictionless, to which he replied, well, that's part of the consultation at the moment, indicating that the government doesn't yet know how frictionless checks will be frictionless. He also said that there is a chance that so important is it that these checks are frictionless that they might well run a pilot exercise as a way of launching this, seemingly oblivious to the fact that for 2 years now, punters have been exposed to affordability checks and that those checks are costing the British racing industry millions of pounds. We're subsequently meeting with the Horse Racing Bettors Forum, in which they believe that Stuart Andrew seems surprised to hear that even betting shop punters are being subjected to affordability checks. There was a Gambling Commission blog later in the week in which they said that betting shop punters wouldn't be impacted by affordability checks. But again, betting shop punters already are being impacted by affordability checks. Many of those will have been Racing Post readers whose letters, some of whose letters we combined and presented to the MPs in advance of the session, and then to Stuart Andrew following the parliamentary sessions. To what extent, Pete, do you think in the government's thinking frictionless really will be frictionless? And were you as perplexed as I was to hear talk of a pilot scheme? As I say, punters are already suffering because of affordability checks.
Lee, I was just listening back to you there and I was thinking, It was remarkable to think that all this stuff was being talked about. And you say, okay, yeah, fair enough. I like the idea of frictionless checks being frictionless. And I like the idea of a pilot. And then you think, well, why is it? Well, if we got 2 years in, it's not the reality, is it? I don't know, it's almost like a think project. This is how we will do it when we get around to it. But in the meantime, you know, like you said, you delivered this dossier of letters. And it's, you know, really thick, you know, it's we get huge numbers of letters in emails in constantly on this subject. I've never known anything like it at the Racing Post. So the ideas of it are all lovely, but the reality is that it's already happening. People are already turning away. People have already had enough. And I don't get how they can be in this position where they think this is a good idea. We'll do these things when it's not the reality of the situation. I mean, people are already turned into the black market, as we know, and as you wrote in your column this week, Lee, you know, that was sort of dismissed as something that's not really a big issue, which again, it just showed, I don't know, it showed a sort of a lack of understanding and a lack of appreciation. I don't know, you just feel that the punters have been left out of this, which I think the Horse Racing Bettors Forum tried to put across, but at the same time, you know, we're a long way down the road for the punters to not being considered in this project.
Yeah, absolutely right. And David, I'm going to come to you in a second, but Pete, you referenced the black market there. That's something I wrote about in my column today, because as you say, Andrew Rhodes was relatively dismissive of the black market as a serious consequence of the white paper, the belief that punters will increasingly move to the black market if they're not allowed to to bet with bookmakers because of affordability checks. I made the point in the piece that's already been happening, also because of restrictions imposed by bookmakers on punters that the Gambling Commission has never really done anything about. Sandra Rhodes did seem pretty dismissive of the black market and also those who claim it to be a significant issue. But I was over in Melbourne in February for the Asian Racing Conference, where we heard that a United Nations body had put a figure of $1.7 trillion a year in terms of what the black market is currently worth in sports gambling. And Martin Purbrick, a senior figure within the Asian Racing Federation, in the column again highlighted to me how serious this is, and was pretty dismissive of the Gambling Commission without actually naming the Gambling Commission. Pete, you've written lots about the black market, even this year you have, in relation to, I suppose, particularly Hong Kong and Citibet. But to dismiss it as a threat over here seems pretty ignorant of the reality, isn't it?
Well, again, it goes back to the point we were just discussing, doesn't it? The put forward in the position that was put forward in the meeting just seems entirely different to how everybody else is engaging with the world. It was put to me by somebody that if Mr. Rhodes thought the black market was such a trivial matter, that perhaps, you know, someone could sign him up to all the black market betting sites so he could be pummeled with the emails that people get from them. I wonder if that was an idea. It could provide some enlightenment in terms of the size of the black market for him, as a thought, possibly. But yeah, I mean, in Asia, the Hong Kong Jockey Club, for example, they have to deal with Citibet, which is essentially the same size as the Hong Kong Tote. So, you know, that, and you talk about mirror sites in your column as well. You know, you can shut down as many black market sites as you want, but they just move to something very similar with a, you know, click of a finger. So it's to sort of dismiss it and say this isn't something that is that much of an issue, just, as I know, completely undersells and presents an image of an organisation that just isn't in touch with reality. And that's the most troubling thing that I felt that came out of the hearings, was that what they're saying, both the minister and the Gambling Commission, is all perfectly interesting and useful, but it's just not the actual case, is it?
No, it's not. And one wonders if over time the government might start to consider whether the Gambling Commission is leading it in the right direction on a number of fronts. David Jennings, what was your take on this from afar, or from Ireland, where, of course, you've got your own very serious issues with gambling legislation?
Yeah, absolutely. I did get to watch a decent chunk of it, and it was the disregard for the black market that really, really baffled me. It was it was almost like, I don't know if you were the same, are these words actually coming out of his mouth? It was very, very strange to watch. From our point of view, yeah, we're in what I suppose was it Alex Ferguson said, squeaky bum time, with regard to our gambling regulation bill, because it's getting serious now, really, really serious. It looks like gambling advertising won't be allowed to be shown on racing TV or Sky Sports Racing in Ireland. There's going to be a watershed, and the consequences are catastrophic, really, because both channels have said they will go immediately off air. It's not financially viable for them to continue if there's no gambling advertising on the channels. And the reports that we're hearing over here is that our minister, who has penned this gambling regulation bill, is not for turning, and this is not going to be changed. It's at the stage at the moment where it's almost the last chance for changes to be made to the bill, and it looks like it's not going to happen, which is really, really, really worrying. And for both nations at the moment, like we're in a position at the moment where you'd almost love in 5 years' time to know where we're going to be, because it's very, very worrying for an industry. And big, big names, like I spoke to Willie Mullins last week, and he spoke about the gambling regulation bill, and even like the road we're going down. And he made some really, really interesting points. And it's just like, where is it all going to end, Lee? It's It's an extremely worrying time for anybody with a love for the sport, because we're really, especially like at the moment, it's just really, really worrying.
Yeah, it absolutely is, and particularly DJ, because I think there's been a feeling, I think certainly watching the situation in Ireland play out, was that at some point in this piece of legislation's path through Parliament, that there would be a point at which amendments were made to the legislation, which would mean that horse racing was protected. But from what you say, we really shouldn't be confident that any changes will be made. And as you say, we really are in the last chance saloon.
We are in the last chance saloon. It's one of those ones, you know, when you hear it like a few months ago and you go, ah, that won't happen. Yeah. You know, that'll never happen. You know, sure, we always hear these big claims and, you know, people exaggerate and, sure, how could that possibly happen? That's nonsense, you know. And now the closer it's getting, you're going, oh, no, the minister now has been really, really stern with this. And James Brown has kind of all, like, the reports that are coming to me are that, you know, this bill could have even been more severe. And there are certain elements that weren't put into the bill that were almost in the bill that would absolutely shock you. And it's looking, the closer it's getting, Lee, the worse it's getting. Like, so the closer it's becoming, it's getting to legislation, it's almost the worse it's getting, because it looks like there's absolutely no hope for change. Now, obviously, these are all secondhand reports, so we don't know just quite how strong they are. But like, it's everybody you talk to now. It's everybody who's in consultation with different government people, and it's getting very seriously. I'm very worried.
Yeah, we could potentially have a situation whereby Racing TV broadcasts Irish racing into homes in Britain, but not into Ireland, which just seems completely bizarre.
It would be laughable, only for it's got to the stage where I can't even laugh about it, because it sounds so stupid that it couldn't possibly happen, that Irish racing, that we can't even watch something that's happening in our own backyard, and like you could potentially have to go to England to watch a race in Ireland. And like, even saying that out loud doesn't even make sense. Like, so it's worrying. And then, as Willie Mullins made the point, like, what's going to happen is it's going to be dodgy boxes. And, you know, as he said himself, like, people who don't have betting accounts with bookmakers are now going to be opening betting accounts with bookmakers to actually watch live streaming of a race. So instead of the idea of this gambling regulation bill in Ireland was to stop problem gambling, but Willie makes the point that it could have the exact opposite effect, because people who pay for a subscription channel like Racing TV won't be able to watch the race on their television screens. People who never had accounts before will open an account to watch the race, and then obviously they have an account and they'll have to put some money in it, and then they're tempted to have a bet because they have a betting account. So it's just, the whole thing is just... I don't know what to say about it anymore, Lee.
Yeah, no, another feeling. Politicians in Ireland and in the UK constantly talk about their desire to protect the best interests of horse racing and to do nothing to damage the sport, while actions speak louder than words, and actions will be critical over the coming weeks and months. Third story, DJ, back to you. The Irish Champions Festival. Aidan O'Brien, he's not bad.
He's all right, yeah, he's all right. I think the most startling statistic of all, he obviously trained his 4,000th winner at the Curra on Sunday, and in a beautiful symmetry. It was in the national stakes with Henry Longfellow, 27 years after his first Group 1 winner in that race, in that very race with Desert King. So Aidan obviously was the story of the weekend, although Sunday didn't go particularly well for him. Henry Longfellow did win, but Ylang Ylang was very disappointing in the Moigler. Kyprios, for all that they were delighted, was still a beaten 4-6 favourite in a four-runner Irish St. Ledger. So I'm sure they were delighted, but I'm sure they thought maybe we might get away with it and maybe we might win. But, you know, the figures are phenomenal. They're astronomical. And the one figure that really stands out is of these 4,000 winners, 417 of them have come in group or grade one races. 417. That means over 10% of Aidan O'Brien's winners are in the top races, group or grade ones. So it's just unbelievable achievement. Obviously, he has the owners, he has the best horses, he has the breeding, but as we've all known over the years, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be a huge hit. You have to be able to train the horses, and Aidan is like nobody I've ever known. He is like his attention to detail, and even when he talks about his horses, listening to the way he talks about them is just, he just knows every inch of them, exactly what they need, their breeding, their dams, their grand dam. He's we will never see in a lifetime. And I spoke to somebody yesterday at the Curra, and I said, at the moment in Ireland, it looks like we're not even going to be able to watch them for much longer. But at the moment in Ireland, we are in the presence of the greatest flat trainer of all time and the greatest jumps trainer of all time in Aidan O'Brien and Willie Mullins. And those two people will never happen again. And it is just remarkable achievement by Aidan, I have to say. But a great weekend, all said, Lee. You know, terrific weather at Leopardstown on Saturday. Crowds-wise, 10,019 showed up to Leopardstown on Saturday, which was slightly down on the year before. There was obviously alternative sporting occasions on, which obviously didn't help. And the Curra yesterday, though, the crowd was nicely up. It was 8,646, which is up from 6,742 in 2022. So that's overall 18,665 compared to 17,022 in 2022. The one thing I will say was, I was in Leopardstown on Saturday. It didn't feel to me like there was 10,000 people there. I thought it was quieter than I expected there, but there was a lot of people kind of fanned out around the course because the weather was so good, and there was a lot of people around the parade ring and stuff, so maybe there was 10,000 people there. But overall, I would have plenty of positive things to say about the rechristened Irish Champions Festival. I'm sure organisers were reasonably happy. I'd say they'd give it a 7.58 out of 10 for the weekend.
Okay, DJ, I'm going to come back to you to take out your particular highlights from the weekend. Pete, it's a cracking weekend of racing, not just at Leopardstown and the Curra, but also Haydock and Longchamp, really good stuff all over. What stood out to you?
Well, I thought, in terms of the Irish Champions Festival, the number of competitive British horses was a real boost to it. It's always something we talk about in terms of the Dublin Racing Festival for the jumps, that, you know, there's not enough British contenders going over. So you can see how having top quality British horses going over and competing really adds to the meet. So I thought that was something that was good to see. I'm intrigued by the crowds and DJ's talk about the crowds. It sounds like they're moving in the right direction, but there's perhaps work to go. And when you've got good horses like Auguste Rodin running and you're not quite getting the crowds in, that must be a slight frustration. What else was there? We say in terms of in Britain, it was great to see regional win the Haydock Spring Cup, £3,500 or Guinea by from Ed Bethel. That was fantastic. Gives us all hope when you see something like that. The Arc Trials car threw up plenty of interest. And of course, the winner, Braden O'Brien in Warm Heart. So it was one of those weekends where I have to say I came away a bit punch drunk in terms of what happened. Every minute there was something else exciting running or going on, which is great. It was good to see the Brits go and really sort of add to the whole meeting in Ireland, I thought.
Yeah, that's a fair point, isn't it, DJ, that one of the reasons why the Dublin Racing Festival maybe hasn't taken off quite as well as it might have been. It's a great meeting, but it just lacks that Anglo-Irish rivalry. But that has been a feature of these 2 days at Leopardstown and the Curra. Although in the biggest race of all over the 2 days, it was APOB, who was victorious again. And you made the point in your colour piece from the track that the easiest, the safest thing for Coolmore to have done would have been to retire August Rodin after the King George. Almost the fact that Aidan O'Brien was happy to run the horse in the Irish Champion Stakes was a tip in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. On your first point there about the Dublin Racing Festival, it is one of the things we would love to see. You know, we'd love to see Paul Nicholls, Nicky Henderson especially. Like, God, what would we give to have Constitution Hill run at the Dublin Racing Festival? But just to put it in perspective, the difference between jumps racing and flat racing in Ireland. So at the weekend, we had 18,665 at the Irish Champions Festival. At the Dublin Racing Festival in February, there was 34,591. So basically, double the amount of people, slightly over double the amount of people, went to the Dublin Racing Festival over Irish Champions Festival, which had glorious weather on Saturday and nice enough weather after a downpour before racing on Sunday. So that just sums it up in a nutshell, to be honest, which is just always going to be the case in Ireland that jump racing is more popular than flat racing. As regards the main race on Saturday, like, for me as a journalist, and Lee, you do this as well, where you have to write colour on big days. So my piece on Saturday, Aidan trained, four of the eight winners on the card. He won the big race with August Rodin. And you write all these things about him. And then you go into Sunday and he trains his 4,000 winner. And you're going, oh, my God, what on earth can I say? Like, I've literally written the same piece a million times. And like, you're going into a thesaurus and you're going, amazing, and seeing what other words there are for amazing. That's what it feels like. So that in itself tells you what Aidan is doing. But what he's done with August Rodin, like this horse, like it's not as if like he's come back from bad runs and he's been disappointing. Like, they have been abysmal runs. Like, they have been, I almost think that if I ran in the Guineas or the King George, I would have finished ahead of August Rodin. And yet he comes out on the back of these to put up career best efforts in the Derby and the Irish Champion Stakes. And the thing that shocked me most was he's the first ever horse that Aidan O'Brien has trained to win the Derby and the Irish Champion Stakes in the same year. High Chaparral did it, but not in the same year. Galileo couldn't do it, and August Rodin could. And, you know, Aidan made the points that, you know, at Ascot he was drawn wide. He flew over. The ground was bad. And he was putting all the, and I was kind of, this is bloody nonsense. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, this horse is finished, and yet he comes out and produces a terrific performance. Chris Cook made the point in his review of the weekend, the Cook review, that it is just ground. It is just ground with August Rodin, but I don't think he's given Aidan O'Brien the credit he deserves. Yes, it is ground, has a large part to do with it, but you still have to get a horse's confidence back. You still have to train them to be cherry ripe on the big day. You have to get their tactics right. I said in my piece, you know, just trying to give it a bit of an analogy, that it was like the tactics in the race were a bit like, you know, Pep Guardiola's inverted fullbacks with Man City, because what they did was they completely bossed the race, and that they were the ones who were always going to strike first, because you had Point Lonsdale, Luxembourg, giving August Rodin a perfect toe into the race, and they judged the pace, as Aidan said afterwards. He said, we wanted to go, if anything, we wanted to go too fast rather than too slow, because August Rodin needs a proper tempo and a rhythm to get into. So to do that and to take the chance that you might go too fast and set it up for closers like Nashua or Al Flaila or King of Steel, I thought it took a fair bit of belief in your own horse to think that August Rodin could win that way. So I thought they got the tactics spot on. And I thought it was a terrific training achievement from Aidan O'Brien. And I really hope he doesn't achieve any more greatness, because I don't know what more to say about him.
Well, Didier, what we can do on that front is that the two of us can maybe swap countries for a few weeks.
Yes.
You can write a few colour pieces on Frankie's farewell tour, of which I seem to have written the same piece four or five times this summer. And I'll do a few on Aidan over there. Just finally, one last question, quickly. Who's a better horse, City of Troy or Henry Longfellow?
I would say on yesterday, Henry Longfellow, because I think he's a quicker horse. I think Henry Longfellow has a more instant acceleration, whereas I think City of Troy is a horse that will be built up, and I think he'd win the Dewhurst City of Troy. I was getting very worried. I know I've been rabbiting on for ages, but I did a column in the paper on Saturday, and I said that I thought this could potentially be the best bunch of juveniles Aidan O'Brien has ever had, and certainly his best since 2001, when he had all those stars like Hawkwing and Rock of Gibraltar. And when Diego Velazquez was anything but impressive, I thought, on Saturday, and I would be far more impressed with the runner-up in this race, Ylang Ylang bombed out in the Meugler. And going into the National Stakes then, when City of Troy was pulled out, I was going, oh my God, this is going to be the biggest jinxed column of all time. So thankfully, Henry Longfellow did the business. But I think he is, if I was ranking them at the moment, I'd probably go Henry Longfellow 1, City of Troy 2, probably now River Tiber 3 and Diego Velazquez 4. But one thing I will say, and I don't know if he was joking or not, but I did say it in my column, that Shamie Heffernan said the best of the lot is still to run. And rumour suggests it could be a horse called Gallantly, who is entered to run, I think, at Nace on Thursday. So keep an eye out for Gallantly, an unraced horse there from Ballydot. But final thing, Lee, we've done the whole front page without mentioning the best performance of the weekend, which was, of course, the mighty Tahira, who is just the story of the summer for me. I think she's exceptional. She just turns up. She does her thing. She travels beautifully through her races. She's trained by a legend. She's ridden by a legend. And like Chris Hayes said afterwards, I just love her to bits.
And I think love is a really nice way to finish the programme. Not completely finish, actually, because I should advise you that we have a spectacular offer in relation to free bets. Okay, that then is pretty much it. We've had some big stories this week, haven't we? We've had the latest from Westminster and Dublin on the gambling legislation going through the two parliaments. Huge stories those are. Both are clearly, and we will keep returning to them in the coming weeks. We had fantastic stuff to reflect on from Leopardstown and the Curragh and elsewhere. But David and Peter, would you forgive me if on this occasion, because of its instant impact, we go with the Kevin Ammo story as story of the week? Is that okay, boys?
Yeah, I'd vote for it myself, Lee.
And Pete, you happy?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Sometimes you don't justifiably take the front page lead, but this week, definitely.
Lovely stuff there then from Pete. Lovely stuff from DJ2. And I end this week's show with great news, because tomorrow, Tuesday, we will have a special What a Shout Betfreds and Ledger preview programme going online. And then on Saturday, in a major Brucey bonus, we will have a live St Ledger preview programme airing from Doncaster. What a Shout preview programme, hosted by Emma Spencer and featuring Paul Keeley and Keith Melrose. 8:30 Saturday morning, live from Donny with Emma. We'll be here next Monday for another edition of The Front Page. Until then, thanks to DJ, thanks to Pete, thanks to you for watching. Bye-bye.